Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents An Alternative History of Britain, The Hundred Years' War, by Timothy Venning, narrated by Liam Gerard. Introduction. The so-called Hundred Years' War is one of the dimly remembered stock clichés of 900 years of fraught Anglo-French relations. In the popular memory, there is a long tradition of mutual antagonism between the nations on either side of the Channel, from the Battle of Hastings in 1066 to Anglo-French disagreement over European centralism. In the case of conflicts, the British usually win, as shown by Crecy, Agincourt, Trafalgar and Waterloo, with London place names such as Nelson's Column a constant reminder. In this tabloid-fueled myth, it seems appropriate that the two kingdoms fought for over 100 years, from 1337 to 1453, though in fact this is a myth, and there were long truces, in particular in Richard II's and Henry IV's reigns. Even under militant Edward III, there were truces in 1350 to 55 and 1360 to 69, and the wars, rather than war, were most active in short bursts in the mid to late 1340s and 1350s, the 1370s, and finally in the struggle launched by Henry V from 1415. One of the underlying reasons for conflict was the English king's possession of lands in France, the remains in the Duchy of Aquitaine of the so-called Angevin Empire of Henry II and Richard I, which was mostly overrun in 1203 to 04. Under the Treaty of 1259, this remained part of France, so the English king, as its lord, was his neighbour's vassal, like the other holders of French feudal fiefs, as those English kings who had been Dukes of Normandy in 1066 to 1204 were the French king's vassals too. This produced inevitable grounds for tension. How could one king be the loyal vassal of his potential enemy, and continual grounds for problems, with legal excuses for confiscation in case of a conflict? If Philip Augustus of France had reconquered Aquitaine, as well as Normandy or Anjou, or the 1259 treaty between Louis IX and Henry III had made the latter fully sovereign in Aquitaine, would there have been less warfare? In the complex mid-medieval world of a pan-European, French-speaking culture, of which the English kings and nobility were part, the post-1066 English kings were, in fact, Dukes of Normandy, who had gained England by conquest. Their politico-cultural orientation was French. The vagaries of the Norman dynasty's succession had seen England and Normandy pass to the son of Henry I's daughter, Matilda's by Count Geoffrey of Anjou, Henry II, Count of Anjou, and buried in Anjou, at Fontevraud, not in England, and overlord of Brittany. Henry added his wife Eleanor's Aquitaine to this huge melange of polities, and was more powerful in France than its king, his overlord. The so-called Plantagenet dynasty, the name was a personal sobriquet of Count Geoffrey, only revived as a surname by the House of York in the mid-15th century, was as much French as English, and until the mid-14th century rarely spoke English. Abandoning its European role after losing Normandy, Anjou in 1204, to concentrate on conquering the British Isles was never a likely option, with a succession of foreign wives an additional incentive. The marriage of Edward II to Isabella of France in 1308 and their son Edward III's resultant claim to the French throne after her three brothers died without surviving sons, 1316 to 28, was the seeming reason for the post-1337 English wars in France. But the situation was more complicated than the matter of honour and justice to pursue his legal claim that Edward's propagandists portrayed. For a start, the Salic law ban on a female inheriting or transmitting a claim to France was not actually stated in 1328 and only appears later in the century, though its being part of the reason for the French court's choice of heir in 1328 is logical. Edward did not pursue his claim until usurper Philip VI had assisted his enemies in Scotland and seemed to be threatening to encircle him, and both Philip's aid to Scotland and confiscation of Aquitaine followed normal precedent for times of Anglo-French tension, for example 1294. Edward was perfectly willing to give up his claim if the price was right, once his demands for a restoration of his ancestors' lands in France had been granted, 1360, but, like French legal threats to their English royal vassals in 1154 to 1337, it remained a latent political weapon, ready for reuse. If Charles V of France had not been able or willing to obstruct the English king's demand, as Dauphin, in 1358 to 60, or showed bad faith in implementing them after 1367, would a war have resumed? What if the distinctly war-averse Richard II, who reached a comprehensive Anglo-French settlement in 1396, despite nobles' objections, had not lost the throne to his aggressive and insecure cousins of the House of Lancaster in 1399, or England had been weakened by his replacement, Henry IV's overthrow in 1400, 1403, or 1405. There would have been no Henry V invading France to restart an attempt to build an English empire in 1415 in these cases. Arguably, Henry would have done better to concentrate his limited resources on reoccupying and fortifying a defensible redoubt in Normandy than claiming the French crown and overstretching his army. But would taking the French crown have ever been practical military politics for this ruthless opportunist, but for the unpremeditated murder of Duke John of Burgundy by the French royalists at Montereau in 1419? This drove his son Philip to throw the huge weight of Burgundian resources onto Henry's side, and when he changed sides again in 1435, the English suffered disaster. If Henry had not died aged 35, could he have conquered France in the 1420s, or at least forced the war into a lengthy stalemate? Was Joan of Arc's appearance in 1429 epoch-making, or the sort of reverse that the overstretched English would have received anyway? And once French fortunes revived, could the English have extricated themselves by abandoning all except a defensible Normandy? Was the humiliating cost of accepting military reality unacceptable to English policymakers, bogged down but too proud to give up? Was the unworldly pacifist, an exaggeration, Henry VI, more realistic than his aggressive uncles, or was he undermined by his fiscal incompetence and poor choice of generals? And did Charles VII of France double-cross Henry in the mid-1440s truce by his hard-line doggedness in trying to retake all the English conquests? Chapter 1. Edward III and Edward IV, the Black Prince. Luck or shrewd judgment? Edward III, the Black Prince, and the comparative English triumphs of 1338 to 60. What was inevitable, and what was down to chance? The claim to France, could it have been made in 1328, not 1338? And was the outbreak of conflict Edward's fault or Philip's? Despite the English victory at Crecy in August 1346 and conquest of Calais in 1347, the practical achievements of the English expeditionary forces by 1355 were limited. Edward III had secured a stunning and unexpected victory against a confident and numerically superior force from the largest state in Western Europe in 1346, showing that a new military power had arrived on the scene. The dominance of French knightly chivalry on the battlefield, and of the comparatively centralised French state in providing finance, men and supplies for war, had been givens of the early 14th century international power system, particularly since the reign of the ruthless Philip IV, 1285 to 1314. France, the largest and most efficient state in Western Europe, and ruled by a line of competent adult male rulers, except in 1316, had even secured a compliant papacy based near its territory at Avignon, with a succession of French or French-allied popes from 1309. King John I had acceded at birth in 1316 and died within days. England seemed to be a marginal minor power, with the defeat of the unimpressive, luckless Edward II by the Scots in 1314 and his overthrow by his French wife, Isabella, in 1326-27, adding to its poor reputation. Despite Edward III's impressive military debut in the 1330s against Scotland, his claim to the throne of France was not expected to succeed against the incumbent Philip VI, 1328-50, not least was the reason that France was over twice the size of England, and as of 1328, the English kings only held the central core of Aquitaine, the province of Guienne surrounding Bordeaux, as a French royal vassal, plus minor and indefensible Ponthieu in Artois. The population of the French king's dominions was around 20 million, and of Edward III's around 5 million, and if fully used, the French king's potential army could be up to 60,000 men strong. The general call-up in France, the arrière-ban, was, however, not applicable to all provinces, and some important ones were exempt. In practice, its alternative of paying a fine, rather than fighting, was often resorted to, and the money used to hire mercenaries. Nor were the French nobility or populace likely to look with favour on a foreign contender for their throne, as we can already discern a degree of basic national rivalry between the English and the French in this period, even though the English elite was French in its culture, as it had been since 1066. Edward III spoke French as his primary language, as had his royal ancestors, although he seems to have been able to speak English too. French was the international language of high culture and chivalry. The first primarily English-speaking king of England was either Edward or his grandson, Richard II, ironically born in France. The choice of Count Philip of Valois, the late King Charles IV's cousin and nearest male heir, as the new King of France after Charles died on the 1st of February 1328, was not universally accepted. The decision had to wait until it was clear that Charles' pregnant widow would not give birth to a son. There were nearer heirs in the female line, from Charles' sister and his brother Louis X's daughter, and it was arguable if the legal, customary ban on female inheritance, the so-called Salic Law, applied to transmitting a claim via a woman to a male. If it did not, either Charles' sister Isabella's son, Edward III of England, or his late brother Louis X's daughter, Jeanne, Queen of Navarre's heirs, were eligible. Edward was closest to Charles IV by blood, but Jeanne's family, from 1332, her son Charles the Bad, were genealogically senior. Jeanne's line had been passed over when Louis X and his infant son John I died in 1316. Edward duly made a claim on France, though not at the time of the succession dispute in 1328, as then he was only 15, and the insecure regency government of his mother and her paramour Roger Mortimer had other priorities. In that context, the Hundred Years' War could have broken out in 1328, not 1338, if it had not been for the English rebellion in 1326, when Edward and his mother, Isabella, invaded to depose his father, Edward II. Due to this, England was not in a state to pursue the claim to France in 1328. The dynamic and warlike Isabella, the so-called she-wolf of France, has received a very bad press from her own time to the present, partly through conventional observers' indignation that a queen could flout normal mores by flagrantly invading England with her lover to depose her husband and led troops in person, and partly from the belief that she was behind her husband's subsequent murder. One theory, championed recently by Ian Mortimer, claims that Edward II was not murdered, but was allowed to flee to the continent in disguise. Whether she was a murderess or not, the point is that Isabella was quite capable of organising and even leading an army to secure her son's claim to France in 1328, if she had not been otherwise preoccupied, heading a shaky regency with her unpopular and ruthless paramour, Roger Mortimer. If her marriage had not broken down due to her husband's involvement with the Despenser family, and possibly his homosexuality, England might have attacked France in the late 1320s, provided that the exhausting and humiliating loss of the Scottish War of Independence was successfully negotiated first. The power-crazed and acquisitive Despensers were unlikely to have encouraged a war had they still been in power in the late 1320s, as Edward II's chief advisers, given that if either Isabella or a royal kinsman, Earl Henry of Lancaster, Earl Edmund of Kent, led an English army to success, they could then turn it on the Despenser regime. Similarly, Edward II was not enthusiastic about waging war in person, and had had a humiliating experience at Bannockburn in 1314, although he was prepared to fight hard, in extremis, for his own preservation, as he did in confronting Earl Thomas of Lancaster in 1322. But an English government that had avoided the polarisation of high politics in 1322-26 might have risked a French venture, at least if there was a threat to their possession of Guienne, which was possible from an overconfident new French king hostile to Isabella, such as Philip VI. The centralising French crown had tried to confiscate Guienne before, 1294, and the fact that, as of 1259, the English king was the former's vassal was a problem easy to exploit. Edward III's formal claim in 1338 only occurred once Philip VI had repeatedly shown his ill will towards his rival, who he seems to have consistently undervalued. The young and highly energetic English king was the type of ruler to seek to revive his grandfather Edward I's successes against France as a morale booster for the monarchy's reputation after the loss of Scotland. But as of 1333-38, he was already engaged in war in the latter country, so he was not free to look for a target. The death of the ailing Robert Bruce in 1329 left his 5-year-old son David II as king, and left the Scots without an adult ruler, and so Edward sought to restore the enforced vassalage of Scotland, which he had had to abandon in the Anglo-Scottish Treaty of 1328 by installing a vassal king to replace David. The physical reconquest of Scotland as an integral part of England was impossible, so that part of Edward I's international strategy had to be abandoned. Instead, Edward III reverted to his grandfather's strategic plan of 1292-96 by restoring the Balliol dynasty, under Edward Balliol, as his vassals. The king did not, however, act rashly. A private expedition by a party of pro-Balliol barons, expelled from Scotland by the Bruces, the disinherited, to restore Edward Balliol and regain their just rights in 1332-33, saw surprising success, with a victory over the Bruces' army at Duplin Moor and the capture of Perth. This initial success showed that the Scots' army was less dangerous than it had been under Robert Bruce. His nephew, the Earl of Moray, and his lieutenant, Sir James Douglas, had both died recently, and so Edward could intervene himself safely in 1333 to aid the disinherited against a Bruce fightback. This led to a major victory at Halidon Hill near Berwick, the conquest of most of the lowlands, and the flight of David II to France. But the Balliol regime soon met serious resistance, and throughout the mid-1330s, Edward III was undertaking regular expeditions to Scotland to back them up. It was then that Philip VI of France not only gave David sanctuary, but sent troops to aid him, 1335, and allowed damaging raids by French warships on southern English ports, principally Portsmouth, the usual embarkation point for English expeditions to France. Even if assisting David II was in the French strategic tradition of trying to weaken England by propping up its northern enemy, the so-called Old Alliance, Philip had less excuse for claiming that Edward's ceremony of homage to him for Guienne in 1331 had been defective and was thus legally invalid. The implication of that was that he could confiscate the duchy whenever he wished. Philip also required Edward to surrender the refugee French dissident noble Robert Artois, and specifically declared in 1336 that any peace was impossible so long as he was in England, the sort of minor issue that could be overlooked with goodwill. Thus, although David II's refusal to abdicate his claim to Scotland for Edward Bruce's lifetime, then succeed him, stymied the 1335-36 papal attempts to solve the Scots crisis, Philip, not Edward, was the main obstacle to a settlement. The papacy, keen for Edward and Philip to use their armies for a crusade in Asia Minor, instead to back up the 1334 naval attack on Smyrna, was endeavouring to sort out the Anglo-French tension throughout this period, and had he been willing, Philip, a man with pretensions as an international crusading leader and with dynastic interests in the Byzantine Empire, could have diverted his energies to the crusade as a devoted son of the Church. There was no foolhardy and unrealistic attempt by a young and inexperienced English king to conquer a kingdom with vastly superior resources. Rather, Edward was driven to respond to repeated French provocations in 1331-37. This culminated with Philip's announcement of the confiscation of Guienne and the title of Duke of Aquitaine in May 1337. Did the insecure new ruler, Philip, feel he ought to emulate his renowned great-uncle Philip IV's confiscation of 1294 and miscalculate the reaction? Notably, Edward and his senior noble commanders gained useful military experience in Scotland, giving him confidence to tackle Philip, and he pursued similar tactics there to his later ones in France, leaving time-consuming sieges alone for ratsier marches. Personalising the issue of Anglo-French conflict, contemporary literature claimed that Count Robert of Artois, who had opposed Philip's claim in 1328, provoked Edward to swear to invade France and seize his rights at a banquet, the Vow of the Heron, by taunting him over his cowardice. This is far too simplistic, though it probably suited Edward for it to be thought that he was a chivalrous hero king, like King Arthur, who undertook solemn vows at ceremonial occasions and was too honourable to back down. The formal English claim was much a diplomatic weapon as an idealistic, non-negotiable decision to claim Edward's legal inheritance. By making himself the rightful King of France, he enabled potential French or French-allied defectors, such as the leadership of Flanders and Brabant, to save face by transferring their allegiance from one usurper King of France to his rival, rather than breaching their oaths of loyalty. At the time of his claim, he was doing his best, in person, to rally the rulers of the Low Countries and northern Germany to his cause, aided by the fact that his wife, Philippa, was sister of local Count William of Hainault, who inopportunately died. Given the size and resources of France compared with England, Edward, like all predecessors waging war on France from the time of Richard I, needed a coalition of European allies to even the odds, provide men and money, and attack France on a second front. This was bound to rely on Flanders, an autonomous county restive under French control since the crushing of past revolts, and the Holy Roman Emperor of the German kingdoms and principalities. Given the pro-French stance of Count Louis of Flanders, to be killed at Crecy in 1346, any English attempt to secure money and troops from the region was likely to be resisted by him and to draw in King Philip too. In financial terms, important Flemish towns such as Ghent, Antwerp and Bruges were vital sources of loans for the impecunious Edward, who visited them in person with his entourage. In military terms, the Flemish ports were also a potential source of invasion threat to England, a major factor as late as 1940. Hence, Edward's initial concentration on securing reliable allies in Flanders and his expedition there in 1339-40, leading to his first crushing victory over the French, at sea, the Battle of Sloss. In Germany, Edward made a prestigious and munificent pilgrimage to the Shrine of the Three Kings, the Magi, at Cologne, and secured a grant of the title of Vicar of the Holy Roman Empire from the Emperor, Louis of Bavaria. This obliged Louis' vassals to support him in war as their sovereign's trusted lieutenant. The most that can be said about Edward's aggression in claiming France in 1337-38 is that he jumped the gun by naming himself King of France in documents while papal mediators were still trying to arrange peace, but chances of the latter were minimal given Philip's equally provocative confiscation of Aquitaine. Under the show of being an honourable paragon of chivalry, keen on his just rights, Edward was to be prepared to abandon his claim if the alternative offers were substantial enough. Indeed, when he first made the claim verbally in 1337, he postponed making a public statement of it by issuing letters patent, or a heraldic coat of arms containing the title, allegedly to satisfy appeals by the alarmed Pope. The formal claim, in writing, and a heraldic device, was only made in 1340, from Flanders on French territory, and thus probably at the request of the local lords to secure their support for him as their rightful king. It was to be retracted in 1360, and modern historians are more convinced than earlier interpreters that for all Edward's bold claims about it being a matter of honour to pursue it to victory, he was quite prepared to reconsider it as practical politics and was less naive than appears. By making such a show of his devotion to the claim, he put up the price for surrendering. Arguably, Practical politics, rather than points of law or honour, were also involved in the French court's rejection of Edward's claims. The Salic law ban was not cited by them in 1328, and they could hardly deny powerful local candidate Philip's claims on behalf of a foreigner. Did Edward in reality understand this, but use it as a weapon after Philip aided Scotland? The First War, from 1338 to 1350. Conquering France, or even recovering the English king's ancestral domains of Normandy, Maine, Anjou, and Aquitaine, would not be easy, or a short process, not least due to the number of walled towns to take and the limited effectiveness of primitive artillery. Maine and Anjou, moreover, were the personal fiefs of the House of Valois, which now held the French throne, so giving them up would seem a mark of ignominy for Philip VI. There was also the minor but psychologically important problem of which kingdom was to be named first in documents. As king of both England and France, Edward would insult his English countrymen if he named France first, but it was the larger and more prestigious of the two kingdoms. In the end, he named England first on documents intended for an English administrative use and audience, and France first on those to be sent to the continent. He could not dodge the issue this way in his official heraldic arms, and thus put the French royal arms in the more important upper left-hand quarter of the device. The size of France and easy defensibility of walled towns presented a more serious problem. Current bombards, primitive cannons, could fire stones at city walls at a slow rate and produce breaches for attackers to use, but were not yet decisive and were cumbersome to cart around. Their first decisive role in a siege was over a century ahead, arguably at Constantinople in 1453. The English king could not afford to take a great number of them with his army anyway, and most sieges had to rely on starving out the defenders or disaffection within the walls. Concentrated work on undermining the walls by sappers and mounting a quick attack was, however, possible, but only on special occasions when a major force was present and speed was the priority. It was also difficult if a town was surrounded by marshes. Mining was impossible, and siege towers would sink in the mud, as at Calais in 1346-47. The English tactic of avoiding slow, piecemeal sieges, but staging impressive marches across large areas of country, had already been seen in Scotland, where Edward had marched right up the northeast coast in 1336, rather than concentrating on securing all the castles to his rear first. As later in France, this and calculated devastation was intended to terrify local nobles into submission, but at most secured ephemeral success in terms of areas controlled. Arguably, Edward was more of a gambler than Edward I in avoiding long sieges, although he kept his nerve during setbacks. The financial crash of the Florentine banking houses of Bardi and Peruzzi, who were funding his war with huge loans, in 1343, failed to curtail his expensive invasion plans, though it now appears that he did not owe nearly as much as the Italian chronicler Villani alleged, 13,000, not 225,000, nor bring the banks down by refusing to pay his debts. There is also the question of the 1341-45 Civil War over the Breton succession to consider. This led to a proxy war between France and England on behalf of their rival claimants, the late Duke John's niece, Jeanne, and her husband Charles of Blois, Philip's nephew, and his half-brother John of Montfort. Ironically, in declaring a female able to inherit Brittany, the Paris Parlement contradicted the Salic law ban that Philip used to justify his inheritance of France, though technically Breton, not French law, was cited. Jeanne and Charles' loyalty to Philip was what counted in Paris, and Montfort was believed to be about to transfer his fealty to Edward. Granting him Brittany could lead to him opening its ports to an English invasion fleet en route to Guienne or Normandy. Philip tried to arrest him, so he fled and called on Edward to back his claim. The English duly invaded Brittany. This gave Edward and his captains, for example the Earl of Salisbury and Sir Walter Manny, invaluable experience of fighting the French on French soil, perhaps making victory in Normandy in 1346 easier. Without this war, would the current Anglo-French truce of Esplanchin have held for longer? but Philip was unlikely to have allowed the potential defector Montfort to take over Brittany. If Duke John had not died in 1341, however, this would have postponed the clash and denied Edward a rehearsal for his Norman War.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?